If you had the smartest Wi-Fi, it'd be Xfinity. It would boost speeds to the devices that needed them most and protect you from threats at home and online. Xfinity. Imagine that. Restrictions apply.
Go KQEI, North Highland, Sacramento.
We love the movie and entertainment business. We believe deeply in its future, and we want to help preserve and strengthen it.
Paramount launches a hostile takeover bid for Warner Brothers, trying to challenge the Netflix deal.
For Monday, December 8th, it's All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Scott Detrow. The conservative majority on the Supreme Court appears ready to back President Trump's decision to fire the Federal Trade Commissioner.
It is not proper for Congress to peel away executive power from the president and give it to someone who's not answerable to the voters.
Also, how some Republican lawmakers are trying to assert their independence from President Trump.
And the weird popularity of a scary holiday monster from Europe who carries a whipping stick.
He's horrible with like lank, greasy hair and sort of cramming children into his mouth.
Those stories and more after this news.
Live from KQED News, I'm Natalia Navarro. State workplace safety regulators say they're investigating the fatal stabbing of a social worker at Zuckerberg San Francisco's General Hospital last week. KQED's labor correspondent Farida Javala Romero reports.
Cal OSHA records show that the public hospital has been fined about $20,000 for at least four violations linked to accidents or complaints since 2017. In one incident, a patient in the acute psychiatric ward punched a nurse on the side of her head and kicked her. She required hospitalization. City Health Department and hospital officials have pledged to conduct a review of the stabbing and improve safety measures. A former patient is in custody and expected to face charges in the attack. The state has up to 6 months to issue citations if it finds safety violations. I'm Farida Javala Romero, KQED News.
The Trump administration today denied Endangered Species Act protection to the Western Coast Chinook salmon in Northern California and Oregon. Administration officials wrote that based on the best available scientific evidence after a review, the species does not require additional protection. But environmental groups say the spring-run Chinook salmon are in significant decline. Jeff Miller is with the Center for Biological Diversity.
I mean, this isn't going to just harm these salmon. It's going to harm all the other wildlife that depends on them. Orcas almost preferentially feed on these spring-run Chinook.
Miller claims tribes and fishermen will also be affected in the long run. He says the group is seeking ways to appeal the federal decision and ways California itself can protect the fish. California fire safety regulations that were supposed to be implemented by the start of 2026 will be pushed back again, the California Board of Forestry announced today. KQED's Danielle Benton has more.
The regulation to create an area 5 feet around a home where nothing can easily catch fire was supposed to be completed by the State Board of Forestry by the start of 2023. That never happened. Then, following the LA fires, Governor Newsom directed they be completed by the end of this year. But the Board of Forestry is delaying the matter until March, citing a lack of public buy-in, concerns over the cost of implementation, and the problem of combating misinformation. Some community groups have told homeowners they'll be required to pull out trees. While trees will need to be limbed, removal of mature trees is not part of the proposal. I'm Danielle Venton, KQED News.
Attorney General Rob Bonta says his office stands ready to assist San Jose officials as they investigate an anti-Semitic incident at a local high school last week. That's after students at Barnum High School formed a swastika with their bodies on the school's football field and posted a photo to social media. Bonta says his office will step in to help if asked by local police and school officials.
There's no room for hate in California, no matter who you are, where you're from, who you love, how you pray, you belong here, and you deserve to be safe and be able to thrive free of hate.
The attorney general noted that in addition to prosecuting hate crimes, his office compiles a report every year examining the data around hate crimes and hate incidents. That information, Bonta says, helps shape policies aimed at countering hate. The West Contra Costa Unified School District teachers' strike is in its third day today, but the picket lines are smaller than last week. That's after district support staff, represented by the Teamsters Union, reached a tentative agreement with the district yesterday. That includes raises and fully paid health benefits by 2026. For teachers, the stalemate continues. Union leaders accuse the district of ghosting them in negotiations, while the district says it's reviewing the union's latest proposal and has invited them to meet tomorrow. Christina Baronian is a teacher at Lake Elementary.
This is about the students, because the teachers' working conditions are the students' learning conditions.
State Superintendent Tony Thurman says he's monitoring the situation and is urging a resolution. More news online at kqed.org. I'm Natalia Navarro.
Support comes from San Francisco Bay University, offering degree programs in tech and business for a world shaped by AI. sfbu.edu. Support for NPR comes from Imaginable Futures, funding programs in the U.S. with the goal of ensuring young children and their parents get the education they need to thrive. Learn more at ImaginableFutures.com. And support for KQED comes from Visit Modesto, celebrating the season with Mochir festivities, from fresh Christmas trees at local farm stands to skating under the lights at Modesto on ice. Details at GetMochir.com. And support comes from listeners like you of KQED News. Marketplace with Kai Risdahl comes your way at 6:30. Now it's more of All Things Considered on a Monday evening at 6:06.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington. One way or another, Hollywood is getting upended. It was just this past Friday that Netflix announced a deal to take over Warner Brothers Discovery, home to hits from Casablanca to Batman. Now, Paramount is mounting a hostile takeover bid. So we've invited our resident authorities to come help explain what is going on. NPR's Maria Aspen covers Wall Street. David Folkenflik covers the media. Hey to you two.
Hey there.
Hey, Mary Louise.
Hey, so, David, you kick us off. My jaw dropped this morning when I saw the Paramount offer, because it upends everything that we thought was going to happen just a few days ago when you were on the show. What is the latest on the fate of Warner Brothers?
Right. Don't nap, because the billions are ascending.
Billions are rolling in, yeah.
They're rolling in. The Netflix bid was valued deal at $83 billion, including debt, to take over really Warner Brothers Studios, the HBO streaming service, or the intellectual property behind DC Comics and, as you say, Casablanca and everything in between, as well as the HBO streaming service. Meanwhile, Paramount Global, the Ellison family, this morning upped the ante. They've offered to buy all of Warner Brothers Discovery, including the cable channels such as CNN. That deal is valued at $108 billion in all.
Yeah. The Ellison family who own Paramount, how big a deal would this be whenever it finally sells? What are the stakes for Hollywood?
Well, so this is a brawl of epic proportions. As you say, the Ellisons, Larry Ellison, the co-founder of Oracle, his son David Ellison, who had been with Skydance Media, they took over Paramount earlier this summer. But Paramount thinks it's still too small. And with this, they think they can compete with the like of Netflix. Here's how David Ellison, the CEO of Paramount, describes why he's interested in the deal.
We love the movie and entertainment business. We believe deeply in its future, and we want to help preserve and strengthen it. Movies are one of America's greatest exports.
And yet they fear they're just too small. Think of the fact that Disney bulked up to take on Netflix by buying most of Fox's Hollywood assets. You know, Netflix is already the world's largest streamer, already the nation's largest streamer. Netflix is saying, look, we can just sort of preempt this whole fight, get HBO, there's a streamer on board, get Warner Brothers Studios on board. We kind of closed the fight before it started.
Well, and as news journalists, I will note there are big stakes here for the news business, too, CNN.
Yeah, right. Netflix isn't interested, you know, nor would Amazon or Apple appear to be the big digital titans. But for a place like Paramount, you know, which already has CBS, they want to fold CNN in and presumably slash a lot of job lines to make this deal work.
Okay, Maria, you hop in here on the Wall Street end of this. Paramount, the tactic they're using here is a hostile takeover. The A-Y and B, how would that work?
Well, as the name implies, Paramount is essentially saying to Warner Brothers Discovery, well, we tried asking you nicely. Now the gloves are coming off. It's going directly to Warner Brothers Discovery shareholders. And this is where we see a difference between the executives of Warner Brothers, who usually call the shots, and its owners, who are all the investors who own the company's stock. Warner Brothers executives chose to go with the Netflix deal, so now Paramount is going to the shareholders and trying to make them a better offer. There are a couple of different kinds of hostile takeovers, but this is what's known as a tender offer. Mm-hmm. Paramount is essentially telling Warner Brothers shareholders, okay, Netflix promised you roughly $28 a share in cash and some stock, but we'll give you $30 a share, all cash. It's not a huge difference, but wouldn't you rather make more money?
I would.
And it'll be all in cash. And a Paramount deal would likely be faster to get regulatory approval. So Paramount is hoping its deal will convince enough shareholders to come over and join it.
Hostile takeovers, I mean, in general, are they effective?
They have a mixed track record. You may remember JetBlue, for example, tried to take over Spirit Airlines a couple of years ago, and that deal started with a hostile takeover bid. A judge did eventually block the deal on antitrust grounds, but there have been some hostile takeovers that have been successful. The Brazilian-Belgian brewery InBev took over Budweiser and Anheuser-Busch. Mm-hmm. That was a hostile takeover. Of course, more recently, we saw Elon Musk acquire Twitter, now X, in a deal that started as a hostile takeover.
One more question to you, Maria, and it's about foreign investors. If you read deep into the small print of this latest offer, the Paramount offer, it suggests significant foreign investors. Who are they? How would they be involved?
There is a lot of Middle Eastern money in this deal. The fine print, as you point out, says that sovereign wealth funds from Saudi Arabia, Abu Dhabi, Qatar, would all have a stake, as well as an investment firm that's tied to China. There's also another investor that would have a stake in this deal, Jared Kushner. Of course, that is President Trump's son-in-law. We should point out a couple of things. First of all, Paramount, as David mentioned, is run by the Ellison family. Larry Ellison is one of the wealthiest people in the world. He's currently worth more than $275 billion. So it's interesting that Paramount is seeking foreign money for this. Now, it's important to note that the tender offer says these investors won't be involved in running the company. Also, Jared Kushner's involvement in this deal is a reminder of just how much President Trump looms over corporate America, and especially all major corporate transactions right now.
David, what role is President Trump poised to play? Do we know?
Listen, in normal times, regulators don't take their cues from the president. These aren't normal times. Trump has clearly indicated for months that he thinks the Ellisons, who are allies, should have an inside track. Yesterday, he said Netflix bid would require him to be involved in thinking about it. But today, interestingly enough, he lashed out at Paramount for airing an interview with an ally turned critic of the president on CBS's 60 Minutes. CBS, of course, the Ellisons recently acquired. That could throw things in doubt as well.
Reporting there from NPR's David Folkenflik and Maria Aspen. Thanks to you both.
You bet.
Thank you.
The Supreme Court appeared ready to grant the president far greater control over independent agencies, upending the balance of power in Washington. In court today, the conservative majority largely backed the Trump administration's assertion that the president should be able to fire those who assist him in carrying out his duties for any reason. NPR's Andrea Hsu reports.
The justices heard arguments today in a case involving President Trump's firing of Federal Trade Commissioner Rebecca Slaughter. The FTC is one of a couple dozen government agencies designed by Congress to have some degree of independence from the White House. Under federal law, the FTC's five members can only be removed for cause. That didn't stop Trump from firing Slaughter back in March. A lower court found her firing unlawful, citing a 1935 precedent called Humphrey's Executor. It put limits on the president's power to remove members of some independent agencies. Today, Solicitor General John Sauer, representing Trump, asked the court to overrule Humphreys, describing it this way.
It has become a decaying husk with bold and particularly dangerous pretensions.
The Trump administration's core argument is that Article 2 of the Constitution vests all the executive power in the president. And yet now you have a bunch of agencies making rules, deciding cases, issuing fines, doing things that affect individuals and businesses all across the country. Sauer said the people running those agencies are not accountable to the president. He argued the president must be able to remove them.
It is not proper for Congress to peel away executive power from the president and give it to someone who's not answerable to the voters.
Now, Justice Kagan said Congress meant to insulate these agencies from politics. She called that the bargain that's existed over the last century between the legislative and executive branches.
And if you take away a half of this bargain, you end up with just massive, uncontrolled, unchecked power in the hands of the president.
Attorney Amit Agarwal, representing Slaughter, said that would be a departure from history and tradition. He said presidents have understood and appreciated that the American people are better served when there are constraints on their own power. And Agarwal brought it back to the FTC. In 1914, Congress created the agency to protect consumers and businesses from unfair competition. If the court gives the president power over the agency, he warned,
tomorrow you'll have a situation where the president can come in and unilaterally decide what constitutes an unfair method of competition, what constitutes an unfair trade practice.
And Agarwal warned the same scenario could play out at other agencies, including the Federal Reserve.
Everything is on the chopping block.
Now, the Supreme Court, through its emergency docket, already signaled that it might create a special carve-out for the Fed, and it will hear arguments on that in January. But in today's case, conservative justices dismissed the idea that granting the president more powers would destabilize the government. Instead, they raised their own hypotheticals of what could happen if the court continues to insulate independent agencies from the president's control. What if Congress decided to give members 20-year terms? Why couldn't Congress just convert traditional cabinet agencies to multi-member commissions? Here's Justice Alito.
How about Veterans Affairs? How about Interior, Labor, EPA, Commerce, Education? What am I missing?
Agriculture.
Mr. Agarwal.
Agarwal acknowledged that it wasn't out of the realm of possibility for Congress to convert a small number of agencies into multi-member commissions, but he said it would have to be worked out through political accommodations between Congress and the president, and so it was unlikely. That answer didn't seem to satisfy the conservatives, including Chief Justice Roberts.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but sometimes that accommodation is greater than in other times. I mean, we have situations, let's say, where the Congress, both houses, are controlled by one party and the president is of the same party, and they may decide that the government would be structured better than by taking over these entities.
While it's difficult to predict how exactly the justices will rule, it appears Humphrey's executor is headed for further erosion, if not erasure. Toward the end of the arguments, Roberts echoed Sauer's description of the 1935 decision, calling it a dried husk. Andrea Hsu, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
If Santa Claus is the good cop of the Christmas season, then Krampus apparently is the bad one. If you've never heard of Krampus, you will in the next segment of the All Things Considered program from NPR News on KQED News. And then it's Marketplace coming ahead at 6:30 with Kai Rizdahl here on KQED. Traffic check time, 6:18 on a Monday evening. Here is Julie Depesh.
It's a bad one on the East Shore Freeway at eastbound 80 after Pinole Valley Road. Right lane taken up with a big rig and a car. You're back up all the way to San Pablo Avenue. Got a couple vehicles colliding in Concord, northbound 680 before the 242 split. Not blocking, but really sluggish back to South Main. Now we've got a stalled big rig in Santa Rosa, south 101 before Steel Lane. That's in the right lane. Your backup starts at Hopper. Julie Depesh for KQED.
Julie, thank you. Traffic support, comes from Glime the Jeweler. And support for KQED comes from Netflix, presenting Apocalypse in the Tropics. The documentary by Petra Costa investigates the fast rise of the evangelical movement in Brazil and the consequences for politics and democracy. Now on Netflix, awards eligible. VisitorsCoverage.com, a marketplace for travel insurance, helping travelers find the right coverage for domestic or international trips, including cancellations, delays, and medical emergencies. Learn more at VisitorsCoverage.com.
4 million Americans are expected to lose health care coverage next year as Affordable Care Act subsidies expire and premiums go up. And some states are going to be hit especially hard. We'll talk about that next time on Marketplace.
Ahead at 6:30, Fresh Air at 7.
On the next Fresh Air, homelessness in America. Patrick Markey spent 2 decades walking through New York City's tunnels, armories, and intake centers where families sleep on floors. His new book, Placeless, asks, what if homelessness isn't a personal failing, but a political choice? And what if the solution is simpler than we think? Join us.
Support for NPR comes from Americans United for Separation of Church and State. Since 1946, AU has supported the First Amendment right of freedom of religion. More at AU.org. And BritBox, committed to helping viewers unbox the unexpected over the holidays with British TV, including original series Lindley and a new season of Karen Peary. Streaming at BritBox.com.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Scott Detrow. This past Saturday, Brigham Young University's storied football season came to a disappointing close. The Cougars had only lost 1 game all year. They had a chance to make it to the college football playoff for the first time in school history, but they fell short, losing to Texas Tech 34-7. BYU has pumped millions into athletics over the years, most recently re-signing its head football coach to a lucrative deal that makes him one of the highest-paid head coaches in the Big 12 Conference. But for decades, officials and boosters of BYU have taken pride in the fact that in their community, morality and principles like frugality have always been front and center. BYU is the flagship school of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And the broader point of its athletic program has always been to spread the word of God. Winning was always secondary. But how does that play out in an era of big conferences, big TV revenue, and big payouts to student athletes? I posed that question to Kevin Reynolds when we spoke earlier today. He covers BYU football for the Salt Lake Tribune.
BYU, I think, is a little bit unique. Unlike other schools that are religiously affiliated, like Notre Dame, you could look at Boston College or Georgetown or whoever, those schools don't directly answer to any religious institution, even though they are religiously affiliated. But BYU is different because BYU is owned and operated directly by the head of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, their sponsoring institution. It plays in Provo, which is 40 minutes away from the church's power structure. The president of the university, the athletic director, they all answer to the church leadership in Salt Lake. And the people who run the church at BYU have said repeatedly that BYU athletics does not exist to win. That's not the main reason why BYU pours all this money. It is to promote the faith. And it becomes this tension where can you pour millions of dollars into football? Can you pour millions of dollars into coaches and still at the same time adhere to the frugality that they have professed as a core tenet of what BYU athletics should do? And also, can they still keep the mission? And Clark Gilbert, who is the commissioner of education for the church and oversees BYU directly, has come out and directly said last year that they will never pay for play. And if they do, it will unravel the religious mission of the university. Yet reality has looked very different from that.
What were you hearing in the days since Kalani Sitake has gotten this enormous contract, the head coach, who we should say was being lured away to Penn State and the school made a press to keep him? And this big deal was the result of that.
I think Kalani Sitake is kind of the prototypical case study in this because he himself grew up a BYU fan. He's a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. He really believes in all the mission of BYU. And it became time when Penn State came in and said that they would pay almost $100 million to get Kalani Sitake that BYU had to pay. But it does create this tension even for this person who for so long believed in what BYU was, is now watching it become maybe something different. And for Kalani, I think personally, I think he's embraced this new era of BYU and he's pushed for more resources to win more games. But at the same time, him getting that contract does also show that BYU is operating completely differently than what they were 10 years ago, 20 years ago, and definitely 40 years ago, where his predecessor kind of built BYU up in the 80s, but did it on a very discount deal.
And the football team
ends the season just outside the playoff picture. The basketball team is spending a ton of money as well and trying to make a deep run in the tournament this year. Seems like this conversation is going to continue because the school continues to be focused on making a national impact in sporting in the coming years.
Absolutely. And from BYU's athletic department, they continuously say that winning expands the mission. And there's nothing wrong with pouring all this money into athletics because, hey, more winning equals higher stages, which is theoretically bringing more attention to the LDS Church, to BYU. And that's exactly what their mission is.
That is Kevin Reynolds, who covers BYU for the Salt Lake Tribune. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And in a statement responding to Kevin's reporting, BYU's athletics department said its spiritual mission is, quote, greatly enhanced when our influence is expanded through winning teams and high-profile players. The school emphasized it needs to, quote, be competitive when it comes to name, image, and likeness, player compensation to do that.
The Christmas season is all about visitors, right? Family, friends, Santa. But you know, in Europe, there is a different December visitor, a terrifying monster who carries a whipping stick instead of toys. And weirdly, people seem to like him. From Portland, Oregon, Dina Pritchett reports on the rise of Krampus.
It's early December, and families are gathering outside Fressen Bakery in Portland to eat Pfeffernuss cookies and Stollen and get their pictures taken for Christmas cards. But they're not lining up to see Santa. They're here for Krampus, a giant hairy monster with goat horns and gnashing teeth, and a long tongue to taste your sins. Edgar Loesch owns the bakery. Growing up, his parents not only warned that Krampus would kidnap him if he misbehaved, they would literally sneak outside and rattle chains.
You go to bed and then suddenly at some point you hear like somebody shuffling outside a bedroom door, scratching on the door.
At Fressen, some pose in mock horror, some giving Krampus a high five. Amy Young brought her 2-year-old Sophie, who was surprisingly excited.
What sound does Krampus make?
Sadly, it ended the way so many holiday photo shoots do.
We were doing so good, Sophie!
The darkness of Krampus is real. But so is the darkness of winter. Sarah Clegg is a folklorist and author of The Dead of Winter, Beware the Krampus and Other Wicked Christmas Creatures. Clegg says in medieval Europe, the end of the year was spooky season.
They are putting on antlers, going door to door, demanding treats. I mean, they're demanding money and alcohol.
And then in the 1500s, the figure of the child eater emerged.
He's horrible with like lank, greasy hair and sort of cramming children into his mouth.
Clegg says over the centuries, child eating monsters slid back in the calendar to the feast of Saint Nick, kind of the stick to Santa's carrot. Krampus is just the version from the Alpine region. But Clegg says by the late 1800s, he becomes the version because of merch. Krampus chocolates, Krampus pepper grinders, and most importantly, Krampus postcards. Some scary, some silly, some something else.
There's sexy Krampus cards. There's like adult lady Krampus with a very big whip. And sort of debonair, handsome, topless Krampus. It's so fun. God, I wish it was still sold.
Recently, Krampus does seem to be making it back into popular culture. There are cutesy Krampus children's books. There's a horror film to show who shows up when you don't get into the Christmas spirit.
His name is Krampus.
You can find Krampus events from Salzburg to San Antonio. About 150 Krampuses and fans gathered in Portland for the 15th annual Krampus Parade. You'd almost think it's a merry bunch of carolers until you look closer. There are horns and antlers and bloody doll parts. Gretchen Brown carries a giant pot and is checking whether my 9-year-old can fit inside.
Would you describe your child as tough and syringy or meat falls off the bone?
You're not going to eat her, are you?
We should note that no kids were harmed. Some of the Krampuses actually handed out candy from their sacks instead of stuffing naughty children into them. But as the sun sets at 4:30, it feels right to embrace the darkness and have a little fun with it. And maybe scare a few children along the way. From Portland, Oregon, I'm Dina Pritchett.
This is NPR News.
There is a traffic slowdown in Orinda at this hour at 6:29. With details, Julie Deppish.
Yeah, caused by that two-vehicle wreck eastbound 24 before a Camino Pablo. Does take the right lane away, so pretty slow coming out of the Caldecott Tunnel. Pinole, the wreck still there, eastbound 80 after Pinole Valley Road. Right lane with a couple vehicles, a big rig included. It's jammed back to San Pablo Avenue. And dealing with that stall big rig, Santa Rosa, south 101 before Steel Lane. It'll be in the right lane, heavy delays from Hopper. Julie Deppish for KQED.
Traffic support comes from Rush Creek Lodge and Spa at Yosemite. Support for KQED comes from Postman, used by over 40 million developers and 98% of the Fortune 500. Postman offers a platform where teams build APIs that help AI agents and humans make smarter decisions. More at postman.com. Audette and Partners, a national law firm representing individuals in complex cases and class actions such as antitrust, whistleblower, consumer, fraud, and personal injury claims for over 25 years. AudetteLaw.com. Marketplace time on KQED News, 6:30.
Marketplace is supported by Progressive Insurance. On the road and at home, customers can simplify their insurance needs and protect what's important by bundling home and auto with Progressive Insurance. Learn more about Progressive and bundling at Progressive.com.
Turns out it's not what you know, but when you know it. Economy-wise, from American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the United States Postal Service, offering holiday postage stamps for purchase at checkout at over 40,000 participating supermarkets and drugstores, and at wholesale clubs, Costco, Walmart, Sam's Club, and BJ's. And by JumpCloud, simplifying IT through its intelligent, unified AI-backed platform that securely connects users to any resource from any device anywhere. JumpCloud, helping organizations prepare for AI acceleration.
In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday today. This one is the 8th of December. Good as it always is to have you along, everybody. We're going to talk in a little bit about the Federal Reserve and what data it's going to be looking at tomorrow and Wednesday as it decides what to do with interest rates and why, in fact, it is meeting without the latest data. But we're going to start with the last best information the central bank is going to have to put into its models, the October count of job openings and layoffs. That'll be along for us tomorrow. Marketplace of Nova Safo gets us going today.
Here's what we know. Inflation has been stubbornly hanging around 2.8% for months. That's above the Federal Reserve's 2% target. Meanwhile, key areas of the labor market are showing signs of weakness, says Elise Gould at the Economic Policy Institute.
So if you look at, let's say, the black unemployment rate, that's been rising pretty steadily over the last few months. Young workers, their unemployment rate has been rising over the last year, almost 2 years.
She says that can indicate things to come for the broader labor market. For the October report on job openings due out tomorrow, Gould will look closely at the rate of new hires, which has been falling.
The hires rate is about where we were in the aftermath of the Great Recession. So think 2013, 2014, not a very strong economy.
But as we know, the labor market isn't the Federal Reserve's only concern. It also works to keep prices stable. And on that front, Aditya Babe of B of A Global Research says the Fed may soon have something new to worry about. And there's a wonky economic term for it, reflation.
In reflation, you have more money, and the risk is that everybody else has more money as well, and so that might drive prices up.
Where's all that money coming from? New tax breaks.
We're going to get $100 billion in consumer stimulus from the Big Beautiful Bill.
He's talking about tax cuts for workers who get overtime and on tips.
Roughly $65 billion is going to hit in the form of larger than expected tax refunds.
For now, the Federal Reserve appears more worried about the labor market, says Kyle Roda at Capital.com. He says a quarter point cut this week is all but certain.
I think the really critical issue at this Fed meeting is perhaps not so much if the Fed cuts or not, but it's the kind of color around the cut.
As in what Chair Jerome Powell says in the aftermath. This time, Rota expects to hear that a December cut doesn't mean a January cut. I'm Nova Safo for Marketplace.
Your homework assignment today, should you choose to accept it, is to look up a Supreme Court case from 1935 called Humphrey's Executor. The citation is 295 U.S. 602, if you're curious. It's about the president's ability to fire the people running independent agencies. And then check out the coverage of today's hearing in a case called Trump v. Slaughter, same topic. And as you read, just know that what's at issue here is almost literally how this economy works. Wall Street on this Monday, which is, again and forever, not the economy. Traders were a little bit cranky. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. As Nova was just telling us, members of the Federal Open Market Committee start their two-day meeting tomorrow, despite having little recent data on this economy. So why not, and this is a totally serious question, why not just wait and reschedule until data does come out? Catherine Ann Edwards is an economist. She's also the host of the Optimist Economy podcast. Catherine, thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me back.
Tick through for me, would you, the information that Jay Powell and the gang have as they head into this meeting?
Not much. We are not going to have data on the month of October, and they will not have ever. No one will ever have that. Yeah. And we won't have November data. It'll come out a couple weeks after the meeting. So the last piece of information they will have is September.
This seems like a very common sense question, but things, you know, at the level of the economy are rarely common sense. Why doesn't Powell just come out and say, you know what? We have been saying forever. I have been saying forever. We need data. Austin Goolsbee, the president of the Chicago Fed, comes on this program all the time and says, I'm a data dog. I need some data, without that weird Southern accent. But you know what I mean? Why don't they just say, look, we're going to push this meeting 10 days. Maybe the markets would like freak out a little bit, but I mean, come on.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a situation where it's a little bit damned if you do, damned if you don't. They would benefit from having more data, and I don't doubt that all of them want it. But at the same time, nothing about the fundamentals of our economy or our current economic situation have changed. And I think that they're, you know, one of the most important issues for the Fed right now is being able to maintain its independence. And I think they must have had some type of calculated decision to say it's more important that we make our schedule than to look like we're serving the whims of whatever is happening for the rest of government.
That's a guess.
Yeah. I'm not in the room.
Well, look, we're all guessing, right?
We're all guessing.
Yeah. Last thing, and then I'll let you go. This is one of those meetings where we're going to get the dot plot, the summary of economic projections, in which members of the Board of Governors and members of the Federal Open Market Committee and regional Fed presidents make their projections about where things are going to go. Some may recognize it as the dot plot. Those calculations are made based on models that they run with data in it. And so now we're going to have people saying, listen, this is where I think inflation is going to be at year end. This is where I think unemployment is going to be in 6 months. And yet the data is not there, right?
Well, not all of them are making projections on data. We know from the last dot plot that the most recent appointee to the Fed, who was still serving in the White House at the time, I mean, his dot plot was not even in the same neighborhood as everybody else's. Some of them are very data and model driven, and some of them are just opinion, and probably all of them are a little bit of intuition.
Right.
Again, I mean, yes, we live and die by data that comes out regularly, and it is on some level so horrible that we won't know the unemployment rate in October, the only month they've missed on record.
Like ever. Yeah.
Ever.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it's still that the threats to the economy are the same. And maybe there's a tenth of a point that they're missing, but they're not missing tariffs. They're not missing that unemployment and prices are both going up, even if they're going up at different, you know, small rates.
All right. Catherine Ann Edwards, she's an economist. She's also a podcaster. It's called the Optimist Economy Podcast. You should listen to it. Catherine, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thanks again for having me.
President Trump spent some time in front of the cameras today, as he is wont to do, and he said, among other things, that he's going to take $12 billion in tariff revenue and use it for farm relief. Tariffs, I am required to remind you here, are taxes paid by American businesses and consumers. Farmers, of course, have been among the groups most directly hit by the president's trade policies. The China soybean market, for example, has essentially evaporated, even as input costs for American farmers keep going up, and as Marketplace's Elizabeth Trovall reports, they are making plans now for the 2026 planting season.
Fifth-generation farmer Jed Bauer grows corn and soybeans in southwest Ohio.
I farm there with my wife and two kids. We're just under 1,100 acres.
Bauer and farmers he represents as head of the National Corn Growers Association have had a tough year.
Since China got out of the market buying soybeans, a lot of growers maybe switched more acres over to corn.
So much corn was grown that it drove down what farmers can sell it for, while the cost of farming stayed high.
It's our fertilizer costs, our chemical costs, our seed costs, and equipment costs.
Bauer says the Trump administration's aid package provides a short-term solution.
That's a Band-Aid. That won't help us long-term, but because we can't get these input prices to come back in line, that will help us get through planting season with some cash flow issues.
Longer-term relief could come through more stable trade relationships. LSU economist Michael Deliberto says soybean markets rallied in the fall when China agreed to buy U.S. soybeans again.
I think what every soybean producer is hoping for now is that China actually starts to follow through. And we are a little bit. Soybean sales have been made to China. And I think it's a step in the right direction to kind of put some of this trade uncertainty at ease.
But there is another country to consider that could affect the fortunes of U.S. farmers. Brazil. It continues to increase corn and soybean production, says Michael Langmeyer with Purdue.
That's going to impact the market for years to come because they just keep adding more supply to the market. And that's not a problem as long as world demand continues to increase.
But if economies like China's struggle, he says, that can weigh on global demand for these commodities. And that hurts U.S. farmers. I'm Elizabeth Trovall for Marketplace.
Unless there's some kind of breakthrough in Congress and a change of heart by the president, in some parts of this country, a lot of people who buy their own health insurance are going to feel more pain when Affordable Care Act subsidies go away in January. Those people, as it turns out, live in Republican-led states that didn't expand Medicaid to cover people who are working, but who are just above the poverty line. The subsidies were kind of a backdoor to get people covered who might qualify for Medicaid if they just moved across the state line. Now, though, millions of those people who would qualify for Medicaid elsewhere are staring at staggering premiums. From WPLN in Nashville, Blake Farmer reports.
Hundreds of cars are lined up in a high school parking lot in Hickman County, Tennessee. Crystal Tipton is driving one of them, waiting for a box of groceries from a local food pantry and reaching for a tissue.
I know you probably need to talk to somebody, so I'm afraid I'm going to get too sick.
She's hoping it's not the flu. But if Tipton needs to see a doctor, at least she has insurance coverage for now. She just received the dreaded letter from Blue Cross Blue Shield of Tennessee. It told her that her plan on the Affordable Care Act marketplace is going from $50 a month to $350. There's no way. But what can she do?
I don't know yet. Pray. That's about all you can do is pray.
Because she's still going to need care. She manages diabetes and an autoimmune disease.
So I'm on certain medications that I have to have.
She's had to use the county health department before and expects that's where she'll be again. Tipton is one of 4 million Americans projected to lose coverage in the new year. It's not just because health insurance is getting more expensive, which it is. It's because generous subsidies implemented in 2021 are expiring. But that pain isn't evenly distributed. For states that didn't expand Medicaid, far more people took advantage of those subsidies. Nicole Rapfogel is a senior policy analyst with the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities.
You have someone who has the same
income in Tennessee as, you know, someone just across the border in Kentucky, North Carolina, Arkansas, Missouri, who just because they live on the other side of the border and they have a very low income, they're able to access Medicaid.
The expiring subsidies, Rep. Fogel says, leveled the playing field between states. Someone who could qualify for Medicaid elsewhere could even get a plan with no monthly premium. That quietly led to a surge in ACA marketplace signups that ballooned more than 200% in Texas, Georgia, and Tennessee. Mandy Spears of the Sycamore Institute, a policy research nonprofit, says the biggest jump, not surprisingly, was among those who would qualify for Medicaid in many states.
So these are folks that don't necessarily have a ton of money, and so they're going to be a lot more price sensitive.
Meaning many will just dump their coverage. In Tennessee, the uninsured rate is projected to jump by 40%. South Carolina and Mississippi could spike 50% or more. Healthcare economist Kara Smith of Belmont University says unless you're using your insurance all the time, it may not seem worth it.
That means people that on the margin are more healthy are going to drop out, leaving that community at a higher per person cost to provide coverage for them. And so it's just kind of a spiral. It's really concerning for us.
Smith calls it a double whammy because the people left behind will be more expensive to insure. They're folks like Kimberly Daft in Old Hickory, Tennessee, who can't afford to go without coverage.
I am at the doctor so much. I mean, I just got out of a 6-day hospital stay.
Being able to get insurance through the ACA marketplace allowed Daft to leave corporate America to start her own business selling specialty houseplants. Her subsidy is also going away, making her monthly premiums rise sevenfold. But she sees no option but to pay whatever it costs.
I'm never not going to be a sick person. I have to have access to good health care to stay alive.
For Daft, skimping on coverage is the last place she'd cut. So it's the rest of her budget that'll get a trim. In Nashville, I'm Blake Farmer for Marketplace. Coming up.
You don't really buy things nowadays without the intention to put it on your Instagram or your TikTok.
If you didn't post about it, did it even happen? Come on. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial is down 215 points today, about 0.5%, 47,739. The NASDAQ down 32 points, about 0.1%. 23,545. The S&P 500 dipped 23 points, about a third of 1%, 6846 there. Paramount Skydance, as you perhaps heard, has come in with a hostile takeover bid for Warner Brothers Discovery worth $108 billion. That includes debt. Comes just days after Warner Brothers agreed to an $83 billion offer from Netflix. Perhaps you've heard about that in the press. It's been out there a little bit, that story. Maybe, perhaps. On Wall Street today, Paramount Skydance jumped 9%, Netflix slumped 3.4%, Warner Brothers Discovery grew about 4.4% today. Bond prices fell, yield on the 10-year T-note went up. That's what happens, 4.16% on the 10-year. You're listening to Marketplace.
The Numbers is supported by Mercury, a fintech that offers banking, credit cards, and financial software. Marketplace is supported by Ninja One, helping organizations manage, protect, and support every device and every user, all from one platform that automates IT and strengthens security. More at ninjaone.com.
Support for KQED comes from San Francisco International Airport, with nonstop service to more than 130 destinations worldwide. Wherever travelers want to go this holiday season, they can get there from SFO. FlySFO.com. Support for the KQED car donation program comes from local Kia dealers, announcing the Season of New Traditions event going on now at local Kia dealers and offering a selection of SUVs, sedans, and hybrids. More info at Kia.com.
On the next Fresh Air, homelessness in America. Patrick Markey spent 2 decades walking through New York City's tunnels, armories, and intake centers where families sleep on floors. His new book, Placeless, asks, what if homelessness isn't a personal failing, but a political choice? And what if the solution is simpler than we think? Join us.
Fresh Air, coming your way at 7 o'clock.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We are at the tail end of third quarter earnings season. Home builders among the industries yet to report. Toll Brothers comes out tomorrow. Lennar and KB Home next week. The latest Census Bureau data we have on housing construction is, well, first of all, it's old. It's from August. And also, it's not great. Building permits were down 11% from August a year ago. Actual housing starts down 6%. Why so bumpy, and are different times perhaps in the offing? Marketplace's Daniel Ackerman has more.
Builders started this year with a good deal of optimism, says Ali Wolf, chief economist with the housing data firm Zonda. Even with elevated interest rates, there seemed to be a lot of people who wanted to buy homes.
Going into 2025, builders were like, okay, the year's at least going to be good. Let's ramp up on new construction.
But come the spring selling season, those buyers just didn't turn up.
Builders found that they had a lot of standing inventory without consumers to buy those homes, so they have no incentive to build more homes if they couldn't sell the homes that they already had available.
Wolf says sales were slowed in part by relatively high mortgage rates. Those could tick down in the coming year, but the cost of building supplies may not, says Anibon Basu, CEO of Sage Policy Group, because the Trump administration has imposed tariffs on many of them.
Softwood lumber or copper, steel, aluminum.
Those import taxes have raised prices for the structure itself and the appliances that go in it. Basu says Trump's immigration crackdown is playing a role too.
If you look at the majority of our roofers in many communities, drywall hangers, painters, so on and so forth, they're immigrants.
And so the number of potential workers in the home building industry right now?
It's much smaller than the amount that we would need in order to be running at maximum efficiency.
Macrina Wilkins is senior research analyst with the Associated General Contractors of America. She says home building is also highly sensitive to borrowing costs. The Federal Reserve is expected to cut interest rates this week, but persistent inflation means those cuts may not continue. When you add it all up for home builders,
2026 has the potential to be better than 2025, but it does depend on whether or not financing costs ease.
Wilkins says demand for new housing will still be there. The question is whether builders will be able to meet it at a price buyers can afford. I'm Daniel Ackerman for Marketplace.
If you're even moderately engaged with pop culture, you're probably aware of Stanley Cups, those reusable water bottles everybody went nuts for a couple of years ago. Or Labubus, right? Those little dolls people are still a little crazy for. They have become status symbols, but the economics behind them says a whole lot about the state of the consumer economy today. Kendall Cunningham had the story in Vox. Thanks for coming on the program.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So I mentioned Labubus and those Stanley tumblers up in the introduction to our little chat here. What else are the big status symbols of the day?
I would say in addition to a lot of like the Pop Mart toys and the little trinkets that we're seeing, like Labubus, you also have Sunny Angels, you have all these water bottles like Stanley Cups and Owalas. Mm-hmm. The Trader Joe's micro tote bag is another like very cheap item that is becoming this like marker of status amongst Gen Z.
Micro tote bag?
Yeah, it's like a $2 like mini tote bag. Wow. That's sort of like the size of a keychain that you attach to presumably another tote bag.
I am so not hip that I don't know what a micro tote bag is. Here's the thing about all these things and why we wanted to talk to you. Used to be that status symbols were to be bald about it, expensive. And if you can get like a $2 keychain fob, and if you can get a Labubu, which costs, I don't know, like $30 maybe. I mean, how does that become a status symbol?
These products are usually limited products. A lot of companies like to use artificial scarcity to sell these products to make them seem a bit more special than they maybe are. And you also have these brands that are like very culty and sort of niche, and that adds this sort of coolness factor to these products. Labubus are a big example of that. The Trader Joe tote bag, which is, again, only $2. But it's very convenient for our times now because we're living in an affordability crisis. Yeah. A lot of Gen Z is not spending money on luxury goods. They're sort of reaching for things that are cheap but are also really flashy and attention-grabbing.
Right. You mentioned Gen Z, and of course, that's in the title of this piece. They don't, most of them, have a whole lot of money. So of necessity, it's the cheaper end stuff that becomes a status symbol. And they, of course, are more into social media, and that feeds into the whole thing. So there's a circularity here.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of questions of whether the popularity of these items are recession indicators. Yeah. The experts that I spoke to weren't totally convinced of that because I think people are sort of always willing to buy little trinkets. But the fact that they're being used as a way to attain like social media clout is a very, is sort of like the key part of this because they are pretty to look at. And they're very wearable. You know, my niece, for example, is very into all like the new water bottles and things like that. Uh-huh. And I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that, you know, you can just like have your water bottle sitting on your desk all day and people can like know you uh-huh. as the person who owns a Stanley Cup.
uh-huh. Yeah, no, I totally get that. I totally get that. Back up for a minute. Social media clout, part of the status of this thing is not just the having of it, but the displaying of it in a very public manner on social.
You know, I would say most things that Gen Z is reaching for, there's a bit of a show and tell element to it. You don't really buy things nowadays without the intention to put it on your Instagram or your TikTok. People want to see the latest, you know, iteration of something or like the different colored Labubus, how you dress them up and things like that. The monetary value doesn't matter as much as, you know, how cool it looks.
Right. And also, I imagine the journey, if you will, of actually getting one.
Yeah, that's another part of it. I feel like most people that I talk to about these items, there's always some sort of story to go along with it. Like, oh, I had to stand in line for this amount of time, or I had to go on this many websites to find it. If you go on YouTube, you'll see a lot of vloggers have this own like subgenre of videos of, you know, I went to two Targets today to search for a Stanley Cup, or it's usually more than that. So it's also this experience that is tied to this cheap item.
Yeah. All right, put up or shut up. Do you partake in this phenomenon, or are you merely a disinterested observer?
Yeah, I'm definitely not like a huge compulsive shopper, so I'm more of a witness to it. I wrote another article about the sort of lipstick effect happening very literally with lip gloss, and I will say that I did participate with buying that, but that's about it.
You know, you got to do what you got to do. I myself am going in search of a Trader Joe's mini tote bag right now. You know, so to each his own.
They're $2. So why not?
$2. Kendall Cunningham at Vox. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Have a good day.
You too.
Marketplace is supported by Odoo, dedicated to providing software designed to scale with businesses. Odoo's programs for manufacturing, accounting, and more aim to provide building blocks for creating a custom software suite. Odoo, what businesses need.
This final note on the way out today, a quick nod to the Chinese economy. Beijing announced today its trade surplus topped $1 trillion last year. That is, it sold $1 trillion more stuff overseas than it bought. The number says a whole lot about the domestic challenges of the Chinese economy. But here is the U.S.-facing data point. Shipments to the United States fell almost 29% year over year. Wonder what's going on there, huh? Amir Bibawi, Kayla Nash, John Gordon, Noya Carr, Amanda Petra, and Stephanie Seek are the Marketplace editing staff. Kelly Silvera is the news director. And I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
This week in KQED Arts, it was a tough year for Bay Area theater, but it still produced a lot of standout moments. Joan Baez in the circus and Hamlet reimagined with barbecue. That's at kqed.org/arts. Your commute begins this time in the East Bay with Julie Deppish.
A new crash, San Lorenzo, heading south 880 before Llewellyn. You'll see that blocking the second lane for the left. And just up the road in San Leandro, we've got a stall north 880 before Marina. SUV that's blocking the second lane for the left. And trouble continues Santa Rosa, south 101 before Steel Lane with the right lane blocked. A stall big rig, a heavy backup there to Mendocino Avenue. Julie Deppish for KQED.
Traffic support comes from Blime, the jeweler. Support for KQED comes from Devils and Details, a Duke Magazine podcast. Listeners can explore Made for This, Blue Chair Conversations, featuring candid interviews with Duke changemakers and what inspires them. Available across podcast platforms.